Well, maybe we should start. Everybody has probably consumed enough coffee, or at least is on their way if they're not here. Saturday, I tried to condense everything into a short time because I knew some people were leaving, but I see some of you are that were at the Saturday discussion are here today, and I apologize for a slight amount of redundancy. My plan this week is to divide the discussion of energy up into four sessions at this hour on the Monday through Thursday. One of the paradoxes of conducting any kind of discussions on energy is that you tend to reach the wrong people. The people who are concerned about the energy, and in particular the management of our dwindling resources of fuel, are the ones who tend to come participate, the ones who you'd like to reach or try to awaken a concern in are the ones who are the hardest to communicate with in this problem.
I can set your mind at ease so far as I'm concerned. I am in control of no energy resources.
You're in fact, oh,
I'm wiped out. I don't have any energy left this morning.
Oh, but you are, Paul. We're all in control of our energy resources. I still, you know, I'm still an idealist. I still think that in a democracy, the sooner or later, the government responds to the will of the people. You know, sometimes I'm very disturbed by the time lag, the fact that sometimes the government is very slow to respond to what the people want. But we won't get off on politics. But I still have faith that sooner or later our government does respond to what we want. But I, what I'm really looking for is a groundswell of popular opinion that will cause our government to do something. As you know, the energy bill has been, you know, subject of debate for some time in Washington, and really the government is moving slowly because I really feel they don't sense yet public opinion. They somehow feel that there ought to be a tax on energy, that the gas tax ought to be raised to reduce energy consumption, but they don't quite dare to pass it at this time because they think there'd be a real furor of public opinion against it, and I think they're waiting for direction. The congressmen that I've talked with say that they just aren't getting mail. People are still concerned about keeping taxes low, and they're not concerned about running out of energy. And I really think that we all do control, you know, a lot of energy. And this is, in fact, this is sort of going to be a theme of my series, I guess, is that the concern is not enough. We've got to become informed about the facts and what is involved, and then we've got to try to make our concerns and our opinions known to our fellow citizens and to our representatives in government, because I think this is the only way we're going to get anything done. As a friend of mine once quipped, the trouble is that too many people still misspell energy OIL. And the people in Washington, the congressmen, don't even know that there is a second law of thermodynamics. And I guess that's one of the reasons why I'm going to try to teach more than I'm going to try to preach on this subject, although I do have some strong opinions on some phases of the energy problem, and I'm sure that my bias will show through even my facade of objectivity. Well, it's certainly no news to you that Americans consume more energy than almost any other people of the world. with only 6% of the population, we consume something like one-third of the total amount of energy that's used in the world. In the last 25 years, the growth rate in energy utilization in the United States has been something like 3% annually, which means that we double the amount of energy consumed in about 20 to 25 years. But worse than that is that in the last decade, this rate has increased from an average 3.2% to 4.3% per year, which decreases the doubling time to something like 17 years. Now these sound like dry statistics, but this doubling time is really critical. If it takes 20 years to double the demand for energy, that's a lot different than taking 15 years or 10 years. The growth rate in consumption of electrical energy is even worse. Present growth rate is something like 7% a year, which leads to about a 10-year doubling time. But apart from the growth in energy consumption, there's been a drastic change in our mix of fuels that we use. Coal has, which we have in abundant supply, has given way almost entirely to oil and gas in the last 25 years. And this is, of course, the reason that our national attention is focused on energy at this time, is the imminent shortage of gas and oil. Our domestic oil production peaked out about 2 years ago, and that was when our importation of oil started to go up very, very rapidly. Natural gas production has peaked out. We have we're unable to produce as much gas now as we were, say, 3 years ago. There are many people that feel that natural gas supplies may run out within the next two decades. Well, what do we do about it all? Well, I feel that some of you, I don't know if any of you were out here 2 years ago when I talked a bit about energy. At that time, I took a little bit different approach to the problem. I guess all these things were kind of impending, and I felt we had to show some real concern and take some rather stringent measures. But it's now 2 years later, and many of these things that were impending have happened. And now I feel we are, if not at, we're very close to the crisis stage, and that we can't sit around and consider all the options. We're going to have to do what I hate to see done, but I'm afraid it's just essential at this point, and that is to pursue several different paths simultaneously. We can't wait and say, let's wait and see which is going to be the best option. I think we have to go along on several paths, or we will be in serious trouble. Now, all the various options, I hope to discuss quite a few of them during this week, can be sort of grouped into three general categories. One, conservation. Two, the substitution of other fuels for oil and gas, which are the most immediate concerns. And then third, the development of alternative sources of energy that will supply our needs for years to come. Now, all of these options, or these general categories, require, I think, economic incentives. There's two ways to change the patterns of energy usage. One is by legislation, and one is by economic incentives of one type or another. I somehow feel that if we can avoid legislative controls, we're better off, because experience has shown that when the laws are passed that people don't want to obey, they fail. For example, I don't think that I would like to see gasoline rationing, because I just don't think it it would work. I think it would be costly, and there'd be 101 ways figured out to get around it. Some of you remember what happened during World War II, and there was gas rationing, and then the national mind was sort of, people were gung-ho, we'll do anything to win the war. And even then, there was there were serious problems with rationing. I seriously question whether that would work now. And it's very, very difficult to legislate the use of energy. I think it has to be done primarily by economic incentives. All three of these, conservation, substitution of alternative forms, development of new energy sources, require a great deal of additional technology. Now, I've heard people say our energy, or try to attribute the present energy shortage to the growth of technology, too much technology. I think this is dead wrong. It's just exactly the opposite is true, in my opinion. The reason that we're in the bind we are right now is that our appetite for the consumption of energy-intensive goods and services has moved ahead of our the technology for converting energy in a manner that's acceptable to the environment, at least. And so I think that any of these, even energy conservation, involves a great deal of technology. For instance, just one example, think of the whole problem of transportation, moving people. We do it in an extremely inefficient, energy inefficient way now with private automobiles. And I think that we have to apply a great deal of new technology to move people around in a manner that uses far less energy and pollutes the environment far, far, far less. Thirdly, I think that all of these measures require popular support. I just don't think you can go in and, Big Brother can go in and plan and say, this is the way we're going to do it. All you people fall in line. Things like that just don't work in our society except in cases of dire emergency, and then only for a very short time. I think we have to have this groundswell of popular support for conservation of energy and for change in the way of energy usage and so on. Now, in my opinion, conservation includes both the less consumption of energy, and some of you now, I know, were here during the past week and participated in Al Pitcher's very fine series of discussions on energy, which pointed out the importance of changing our national lifestyle. I thoroughly agree with Al that this is a very, very important component of energy conservation. We just have to change our style of living from an energy intensive one to a less intensive one. But apart from that, conservation also includes the more efficient utilization of energy. And there's an opportunity for saving a tremendous amount of energy without actually reducing our standard of living. And I'll try to devote most of one session to ways and means that I think we can do this. Well, let's look at a few hard facts and figures. I want to leave a lot of time for discussion, but I don't know. I was warning you earlier, if you can't see the slides or the blackboard, why you probably want to move my energy sources over there, and the cord is only so long. Now, you've probably looked at all sorts of graphs like this, and there's, of course, once you go beyond the year 1975, it depends upon what kind of a projection you use. But regardless of whether you take a 10-year doubling time or a 20-year doubling time or what, the curves almost invariably point upward like this. Now, this has attempted to predict the, or extrapolate, I should say, from what the past experience has been to the future, our need for energy and the probable sources of this energy. Coal shows a modest increase in utilization. I would hope that by the year 2000, coal might show a slightly greater portion of the total. The nuclear part, at least according to this projection, shows quite a rapid growth. There's a serious question now as to whether it will, in fact. The domestic oil production, as I said, peaked out 2 years ago, but the rate of decline will not be terribly great. Domestic oil sources will continue to account for about the same part of our energy utilization. Oil imports will certainly go up, barring any drastic change in the international political situation. Natural gas will show some increase, but domestic natural gas, as I say, has peaked out. Now, this curve looks slightly more optimistic until you note that energy scale is a logarithmic one. That is one where every unit in the vertical direction does not mean the same. So that this tends to change a what we call an exponential curve into one that's a linearly increasing curve. It tends to make things look better, but you have to remember that this is in fact an exponential curve. Now this goes back way, way back to 1850 and takes things up to the present day. I was quite astounded when I started studying the economics of energy utilization to realize that how energy intensive American have always been from the, I guess from the year one, from the time the country was founded. We have always used far more energy per capita than any other part of the world. In fact, the present energy consumption per capita now is not a great deal different from what it was 200 years ago. We haven't shown any 100-fold or 10-fold or 4-fold. I think the actual increase per capita energy consumption is something like a 2-fold increase. And most of that 2-fold increase, interestingly enough, took place within the first decade or so after World War II, when the workforce began to increase very drastically. You can, I've heard this tied to women's liberation and everything else. You know, as long as there was only one wage earner in the family and the mama stayed home, the home took a certain amount of energy, and Papa's office or factory or where he worked, he used a certain amount of energy. But when Mama and Papa both go to work, the home still stays heated, and Papa needs an office or a factory, and Mama needs an office or a factory. And this, since a very large part of our energy consumption is directly tied to industrial processes and industrial space heating, any increase in the workforce is going to show up as an increase in energy. Well, we'll talk about this, the complexity of this, later when we talk about energy consumption. But we've always been an energy-intensive society. You think of even back in the good old days when space heating was by cutting down the forests and burning wood, and transportation was by feeding oats to old Dobbin. And you know, you don't get very many miles for a bucket of oats or per BTU of fuel transporting things by horse. It's not a very energy efficient way of doing things at all. Well, focusing a little bit on the last two decades now, the United States consumption of energy resources by major sources, you see here, of course, what I'm sure you all are quite aware of, that our use, the great increase in energy use has been in oil and gas. The utilization of coal has stayed more or less constant over the past two decades. The nuclear part of our energy, total energy usage, is still so small that it accounts for only a small fraction of a percent. There are some countries now, notably England and France, where the nuclear part of energy is an appreciable portion, and there is present plans in this country are to use nuclear energy to take up a large part of the projected increase over the next decade or so. And of course, there are a lot of people that are very concerned about what this means, and we'll devote probably a good part of the discussion tomorrow to talking about nuclear power and the pros and cons of it and what this is going to mean. But in the past two decades, most of the increase has been taken up by oil and gas. And that's, of course, one of the reasons why we are in the dilemma we are today. Oil and gas are beautiful fuels. They're very low in pollution. They're easy to transport. Up to this time, they've been very cheap. And they're marvelous fuels. The only trouble is that we just don't have very much of them. We don't have enough of them. In fact, puts things down in terms of shortfall. How much natural gas shortfall we expect to have, how much oil shortfall we expect to have, and so on and so forth, and how much then is going to have to be taken up by imports. Well, here is an attempt to present the present flow of energy in a little bit different way. Instead of looking at figures, now you look at colored lines. The end result of our energy utilization is shown at the right. Our industrial utilization is about 37%. Transportation use is up 25%. Residential and commercial usage, that is heating and lighting mainly, use 22%. And the conversion and transmission losses of various kinds take up about 16%. Most of the present production of energy goes through what one might call the thermal bottleneck. That is, we use various types of fuel to produce heat, which in turn is converted into electrical energy or some other type of energy. And the plain fact of the technological fact of the matter is that when you convert thermal energy to some other form, you must of necessity have exhaust heat. This fact is often overlooked by proponents of solar energy or things like that. You just simply cannot have conversion of energy into electricity or into mechanical energy without also having waste heat. Now, some types of power plant are more efficient than others and convert a greater portion of the fuel into the desired form of energy and exhaust less waste heat. Mobile sources, the sources of energy conversion that we use in transportation systems, tend to be very low in efficiency and have a very high amount of exhaust heat. Stationary sources can be more efficient. In stationary sources, the efficiency of conversion to at least a first approximation depends upon how hot you can run your boilers or your conversion units, and how cold the exhaust can be. One of the reasons why nuclear power or electric power companies are reluctant to go from water-cooled energy systems to air-cooled energy systems, because the efficiency goes down, even though the air is a much better heat sink for the for the excess heat than streams and lakes are, but there's a sacrifice in efficiency, and you just can't get away from that. The texts that I'll be using for this series of discussions is a quotation from, or a statement made by Senator Jackson. We're out in Jackson country now. I don't agree with everything Scoop Jackson says, but I think he was in fact prophetic when he said this. I think I'm going to stop, at least pause at this point. I can say a lot more about various types about the technology and so on of energy conversion, but I'd like to open things up for discussion now and hear a little bit about your concerns. We're going to go back and talk about all of these alternatives, or at least that's what I plan, in some detail, but I'd like to hear a little bit about your thoughts on the subject and see what your concerns are. This may guide me in what we're going to do and where we're going to go from here.
I think I've read somewhere that if we look back at the history of the use of energy, that changes from one energy source to another have only occurred when the populace were forced to change. I believe the example that's often cited is the case of England. England depended on wood as their source of heat and whatever you use wood for.
Mm-hmm.
And it was only when the wood was exhausted that England developed their coal resources.
Oh.
If this is true, well then probably we will continue to be lethargic until we're forced
to convert
and change.
Of course, this wouldn't apply now, would it, to our conversion from coal to oil? When we were young, most homes were heated by coal.
Well, we were forced more or less by the smoggy condition in all our cities.
Not out on the Minnesota prairie. It was purely economic, I think. And convenience. We didn't like having to go down and stoke the furnace before we went to bed at night. But a lot of it was cost. I know a lot of people converted to natural gas because it was cheap. In fact, it still is cheap. I haven't really kept that careful tabs on coal prices, but I guess right now you can still heat a house cheaper with natural gas than with either coal or fuel oil, can you not? But it
depends on where you are.
Depends upon where you are, yeah. But it was certainly mainly a matter of convenience, wasn't it, that dictated this last big change from coal to petroleum products?
Of course, many cities passed legislation that practically outlawed the use of coal. You could only use
clean air acts.
Certain types of smokeless coal, but they're in such short supply that the effect is not that you have to switch over all the gas.
Yeah.
I before Minneapolis and St. Paul passed their smoke regulation ordinances. There used to be a pall of smoke hanging over the Twin Cities all winter long. From Woody Fall to Phoenix up there, remember it was a Sunday, it was smoke, 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 smoke.
Mm-hmm.
You could see it for miles from the Twin Cities. And of course, the teams came that were forced to use the smoke as fuel, such as anthracite coal or certain types of West Virginia coal. They were in such short supply. You never were mined in sufficient supply for the job, so of course, the substitute brought in.
Yeah.
I'm not aware of the context of which the quote that you have there, Senator Jackson's taken. Since he points that out, he apparently thinks something should have been done. Now, for industry to have done it, economic conditions would have had to be different. Therefore, do you think he meant that government should, in fact, have caused this to happen from the beginning?
I don't really know what he meant. I can tell you what I think should have happened. One of the problems, of course, is that the energy industry is not a single industry. Let's take just one example. Let's compare the electric utilities with, say, Mother Bell, the telephone utility. Now, the telephone company, I certainly have some criticisms of the telephone utility. It isn't perfect, but it's one thing that you have to really admire the telephone utility for is the way in which they have, even though they have an absolute monopoly, they have always made it a practice to plow a certain percentage of revenues back into research and development. And Bell Telephone Laboratories is certainly the premier industrial laboratory in the country. It has been for many, many years. And things like the transistors and lasers and all these kinds of things were all developed by taking a 1.5% or whatever it is bite out of all our telephone bills. Now, in my opinion, the electric utility should have been doing this for years. They have done almost zero. There now is a research institute that's supported, the Edison Electric Institute, that's supported by the electric companies, but on a volunteer basis. And in other words, they're supposed to contribute some money, but whether they do or not is entirely up to them and their stockholders. And the Electric Research Institute is not a big factor at all. 99%+ of the research and development on ways of improving the product, in the case of electrical power, has come at taxpayer expense. And I see this as a real, as one of the reasons we are in trouble. I think one of the better utilities in Illinois, Commonwealth Edison, is quite a well-managed utility, and our electric power in Illinois is a lot cheaper than it is in New York, and I'm sure that part of this is due to our utility company. But they were under fire here some months ago for spending five times as much money on advertising, even in light of the energy shortage, five times as much money on advertising as they were on research and development to improve their products. And that's really been the history of the electrical power industry.
Isn't that really a case in which the research was being done by the suppliers of the utilities? I mean, there have been very substantial improvements in the efficiency of steam generating
arguments over the past half century. But the research was not done by the utilities, it was done by Westinghouse, GE, and Alice Chalmers, and the suppliers of the Hoover equipment. Well, the same would be true also for research into transmission.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess I'm not aware of any tremendous change in the steam generating equipment over the last few decades. There have been minor improvements, but a steam system of today is not that much different than a steam system of 20 years ago, is it?
No, it isn't, but the efficiency is noticeably greater.
It's somewhat greater because, in case of steam generating equipment, of course, the efficiency is almost entirely determined by the boiler temperature. If you can operate boilers at 600 degrees, you get a greater efficiency than if you operate them at 500 or 400. But they're really...
Reliability and things like that.
Yeah. Yeah. But there really hasn't been an all, I don't think, in my opinion, the percentage of the revenue now, the electric power, the revenue from sale of electric power is something like $25 billion a year. And goodness gracious, if you put plowed 1% of that back into research and development, well, we wouldn't be in the kind of trouble that we are now. And I think most forward-looking in manufacturing or industrial establishments do try to plow at least a 1%. A highly technological industry would probably run more like 2 or 3%. And there's big money in energy generation and selling. And there has been for many, many years. When the price of gas goes up 1 cent at the gas pumps, and we've seen that happen many, many times in the last year, every time the price of gas goes up one penny, why, that increases the revenue by over $1 billion, something like $1.1 billion, I think it is. So that how much has gas gone up in the last 2 years? Something like 25 or 30 cents. That accounts for between $25 and $30 billion a year. 1 year's windfall revenue in the present, and I call it a gasoline ripoff, would more than finance all the energy that's been done on research and all the expenditure for research and development of alternative sources of energy since the year one.
Energy conference this last week in Portland, Oregon, sponsored by the Oregon State.
Oh yeah, very good.
Anyhow, I was going to say it was interesting in your comment that you placed conservation first.
Mm-hmm.
And the principal speaker at this conference was I've forgotten his name, but he was from Washington, in this new energy administration that they have. And when they set this up, Congress set it up, so they set it up with the idea of having various divisions for solar power and nuclear and all that. And somebody, with an afterthought, said, well, how about conservation?
Mm-hmm.
They thought about it last rather than first. It seems to me that this is the way we should be going, to put more effort into conservation and all in the sources.
Yeah. No, conservation has to, has to be a very important part of it. And I guess that's where I take a little different approach than probably Al Pitcher does. I don't think conservation, any major amount of conservation at this point, is enough to get us over the hill, unless we just absolutely shut down our whole industrial establishment. And I don't think we're very many people in the country are prepared for the kind of a major depression that this would bring. In other words, for conservation to do it, take care of the problem alone would require such a drastic change in not only our lifestyle but the whole American economic structure. Well, it may be that we're due for that, but I don't think we're prepared to make a sudden change in our whole structure.
I have one more comment. In contrast to some of the comments made over here, I saw another projection made, and it seems more optimistic way of looking at things than these people expressed. And that was that when there seemed to be a need for a new energy source that seemed to appear on the horizon, and this seems going back some...
I wish that were true.
Going back some years, we had Dobbin and so on, and then all of a sudden we discovered coal and oil and so on, and these seemed to appear on the horizon just at the time when we needed them. Maybe we've run out of resources now.
Well, part of it, of course, it's a matter of time scale. Now, the conversion from wood to coal, for example, took place over 60 years or so.
Yeah.
And the conversion of coal to oil was a very gradual thing.
This is about the time scale that
yeah.
we were talking about.
And I think if we had if we'd done our homework over the last few years, this might be very much, and we could sort of let nature take its course. But right now, I think the hands on the clock are at 2 minutes or 5 minutes before midnight, and I think we have to make slightly more drastic changes than probably we would like to in the normal course of things.
I heard for the first time, I heard about its feasibility, but on the radio coming here the other day, I heard a building, one here in the United States, a smaller structure, 6-7 stories, and one much larger in scope being built in Canada, that will be, the energy will come from human beings, 60% of it, for the lights, for the heat, for the air conditioning, for everything, both in the preservation of our 98.6 degrees of heat, much more than we need for our comfort zone, and secondly, the human waste part of it. And the Canadians are building a 20-story building, and the Americans have got one that's either completed and in use. I didn't quite catch that. I don't know if you...
I am not familiar with this particular proposal. It sounds a bit pie in the sky-ish.
There's no storage capability,
yeah.
So it'd be during the time that people are there,
mm-hmm.
they would be totally, it says, they would not rely on any outside source of energy, but of course when they're not there, they would have to use either electricity.
Do you know something
about that? And that's true, but every office building, every building, because of that load, has to air condition. Even if it's down to 20 below zero, there's still air conditioning in that because of the load factor of lights. Computers are the biggest heat source for office buildings. You can take care of about a 10-story office building with a fair-sized computer, entirely off the heat generated by that computer, just by recycling.
Well, that depends upon where you are. I would doubt very much if you could do this in a cold.
With the right construction, I think you can.
That sounds like the kind of thing that my Weekly Reader magazine used to talk about when I was in grade school in the 50s also. They always wrote about all these neat things that were on the horizon.
Mm-hmm.
In 10 years,
we'll have this and this. Yeah.
Where is all that? And that's
Well, that's what I said. This was kind of starting because this is something that was in construction or being completed in this. Of course, it demanded great dramatic changes in construction and in appearance. The inside having most of the being of reflectant substances to maintain, to reflect the heat back into the units where the people were dwelling.
Yeah, but you to talk about something like that, you're talking about the sealed box idea now, and people just don't like to live and live in sealed boxes. People like to go in and out of doors and like to communicate with the outside and so on like that. And it doesn't take very many door openings on a cold day before you've completely upset this kind of thing. Well, let's do a few little calculations. Ordinarily now, if we're not running a treadmill or something, we're sitting around, we generate, about 300 watts? Okay. 300 to 400 watts, depending upon how much of us there is burning up food. How many people are you going to put per cubic foot of, or really in this case, if you're going to talk about a sealed box, per square foot of wall space? Unless you have I think pretty soon you'd conclude that it's not kind of a lifestyle very many people would want. We crowd a lot of people in a room and they never leave it, or they never leave the building, and so on and so forth. I really would doubt very much whether this is a very practical thing, or whether this even is the whole story.
Well, I doubt it. I just, because I heard it just coming in here on Sunday morning.
There certainly are. One of the things that worries me a little, but not very much yet, of course, is that the quackery that's kind of growing up, especially it seems to right now center around solar energy. Everybody and their grandmother are starting little companies to build solar heating devices. And you've got to be a little careful about these. You can pick up the Popular Science and you'll find pages of ads. Send in $10 and we'll send you plans for a solar heating unit and things of this sort. Or on a bigger scale, some of you may that follow the stock market realize or are aware of what happened when Varian Industries announced a new process, really, was all it was, a manufacturing process for gallium arsenide. And they announced that their gallium arsenide photodiodes had achieved something like a 18% efficiency under ideal laboratory conditions, and immediately in 3 days the stock went up by 60%. And Varian's a big company, so when that stock goes up from $11 to $17, why, that's many, many, many millions of dollars on Wall Street. And I think the Varian people were probably the most amazed of all, because it wasn't any major breakthrough. It was a piece of good news, but it had this solar energy ring in it. I'd hate to see energy become like the word computer was back in the 60s. Any company that had computer in its name could go out and sell stock on the on Main Street, and nobody even bothered to investigate whether the what they had to sell was going to have any value at all or not. But I'm not worried. I'm not very worried about that yet. But it could be a problem. I think you have to be a bit practical and evaluate some of these schemes. And like I said, I don't know. I've never heard of this particular one, but you can find plenty of them in the popular magazines now.
I was interested in what this gentleman said about the heat emission from a computer.
would be sufficient to heat a 10-story building. I suppose it depends on the size of the computer and how the building is constructed. But nevertheless, one immediately gets a picture of tremendous heat emission from a computer. Is this true of the most modern computers that are so miniaturized that they are supposedly very small consumers of energy in proportion to their ability to perform work?
Well, they give off a tremendous amount of heat. And due to that fact, the air conditioning to keep one of these things going is tremendous.
I didn't realize this.
What do they have to keep it at?
Depends on the computer and the method of computing. But it must be within a certain range, 24 hours a day.
The first computing that depended on tubes.
Much higher.
Yeah, that was something else. Yeah. These radios and the TVs, the amount of heat emission
still
is much smaller than it used to be.
It still takes a tremendous amount.
When President Ford talks about becoming energy self-sufficient, at least in terms of oil, is that feasible? As you see?
No. No, I have not heard Ford refer to energy self-sufficiency on any time scale. The Project Independence, you may have seen reference in some of these energy messages to it, but I sort of thought Project Independence was dead and buried. The Nixon administration had set as the target the independence from foreign sources of energy by 1980. Well, as soon as people got out pencil and paper, I think they pretty much realized that would not be it was not a feasible goal. It was fine to work toward it. But it was not feasible, and in fact, in the months since Project Independence was announced, the level of foreign imports of fuel had gone up quite appreciably. And we haven't even come to the point where we could talk about leveling off, much less to reduce them to zero. I don't think we're going to become independent of foreign sources of imported sources of fuel for a good many years.
What kind of impact will the Alaska pipeline have on our source of oil?
Well, the problem, of course, is that the Alaska pipeline doesn't come down here. There is talk about a trans-Canadian pipeline, which, of course, would have a tremendous effect. The Alaskan pipeline will certainly have an effect, but there's still a lot of miles of ocean between Anchorage, Alaska, and even Seattle, even the nearest port. And
Bell
in fact,
Denver.
Pardon?
Bell Denver.
Aren't they going to run all the way across to, or is it just to Bell Denver? Well, anyway, from wherever they load it down to the consumer, there's still a lot of ocean. And I don't know just what's going to happen. Now, in terms of by the time the pipeline is completed, who knows what the price of oil is going to be. It may be that
they're reporting something like the Alaska pipeline will supply 2 to 3% of our needs.
How much?
2 to 3%.
Is that all, really? I was thinking there would be more than that because of the, as I say, by the time the price, or by the time the thing is completed, the price is going to be high enough so that they'll probably extract the North Slope oil a lot faster than might have been projected when the pipeline started.
The pipeline has only a certain capacity.
Yeah. Well, but
they're projecting now to make another pipeline with gas beside it.
Yeah.
Beside it,
but that would be beside it just and ship liquefied gas. I know there's talk about trying to get a trans-Canadian pipeline to bring that energy directly into the United States. But anyway, it's not going to, I don't think the OPEC countries are shaking in their boots over the Alaskan pipeline. It's certainly going to help our national energy situation a great deal, but it isn't going to solve it by any means.
It's
only 2 or 3%, and we expand our oil usage by 5%, that isn't going to help very much.
Yeah. I was thinking that it was higher than that, but let me check on that.
I've heard so many different potential sources of energy discussed, and the one they never discuss, and the one that I, of course, is completely unable to discuss, and the reason I'm bringing it up is that I feel too quite good is that when we can harness the force that causes the world to spin and the planet to rush through space, and goodness, what the energy will have. Because I don't know what that source is.
Gravity, I guess. The only thing that really even approaches that, of course, is tidal energy. In order to harness, any kind of celestial energy or something, you have to have a...
Well, you coined the name for it now. Celestial
energy, or whatever you want.
I know what it is.
Energy from heaven, or you've got to have some kind of a differential in terms. I use the term heat source and heat sink in terms of thermal energy. You've got to have a change in something. A potential of attraction of the moon. The water changes level, but that's only in certain selected portions of the world. The French have a very large tidal power station. The if you look back through the congressional record, you find the Passamaquoddy Bay of Fundy project has been a kind of a pet of the Kennedy family ever since JFK was first elected to Congress. They've kept on introducing bills, but they never get through Congress. I'm not sure I understand what. Well, the reason, of course, is that the capital development cost is very, very high. But I think there's more to it than that. I think it's a question of regional. Another people that oppose it say this is another TVA type thing. We don't want federal government developing a huge source of power like this. And there's a lot of political ramifications. But we, assuming, okay, that we develop Passamaquoddy Bay, there's a lot of energy there. But there aren't very many other places like that in the United States that have that I've ever seen have full promise for any kind of tidal power.
You identified as gravity the force that causes the earth to spin.
Well, I was thinking of the Earth moving about the sun, but the Earth spinning on its axis, really there's no energy involved, there's no force, I should say. The Earth started to spin, and there's nothing has gotten in its way to stop it.
Well, but nevertheless, I think there's tremendous energy there.
Oh, of course there is.
There's tremendous energy.
Of course there is.
Of course, we haven't learned how to tap it, that's the only problem.
And we don't know what happens when we do try and stop it.
Well, we are told that if we did stop it, everything would all fly apart.
But, well, even if I knew how to convert some of the Earth's rotational energy into, eventually, of course, it all gets into heat, I don't know that I would advocate doing it. There are many, many other things that would happen that would not be so desirable if the Earth started to slow down. If you increase the length of the days, what happens to the heat balance in the atmosphere and all sorts of dire things?
Mm-hmm. How about getting that infinite heat source that's only a few miles below us?
Geothermal
center of the Earth.
Yeah. Well, that certainly is in the cards. Of course, the most attractive place to go after it is where that heat source gets fairly close to the surface of the Earth. And there certainly is a lot of thought being given to geothermal conversion out in, especially in California and all Northern California, where the where there is a great deal of thermal activity near the surface of the earth.
Pretty low grade energy. I was thinking of going down a little further.
What distance are we talking about? 50, 100?
Depends upon how, he used a good word, he said low grade energy, depends upon how much of an energy difference you want. The the efficiency of any kind of a thermal energy converter depends upon the temperature of the source and the sink. Now, there has been a proposal, and this is one of the things we'll talk about, of using even ocean gradients, which may only be 20, 25 degrees. This means very inefficient use, but if you've got enough of it, you can still pick up a fair amount of energy. And the same is true of geothermal. If you go down so many miles with your wells, you'll get into rock at a certain temperature. If you can figure out a way to inexpensively drill a well 100 miles deep while you're in. But that's the kicker, of course.
Yeah.
It's very, very difficult to tap into that heat source because there's a lot of cold rock between us and it.
I read of a conference, I think a year ago, where scientists from all over the world were being brought to Costa Florida or someplace where the current is overflowing.
Mm-hmm.
In a certain direction, but the idea of putting windmill type generators in the water.
Mm-hmm.
And has anyone ever seen the result of that conference? It seems, really practical.
I don't know the particular conference you're talking about. I think the a more practical way of, there are more practical ways of converting this thermal difference in the ocean. Ocean
this
currents are hard to predict.
This is flow of water.
Well, it's thermal. That's what keeps the currents going, right? Yeah. Ocean currents are hard to tap into. I haven't seen any really good proposal for doing this. It's parallel with the technology of wind conversion. You just need such gigantic source, collectors and things to get any appreciable amount of energy. I'm not aware of this particular conference, but...
I've lived in a time when one little tiny generator supplied a farm, from wind power.
Sure.
And I don't know that it was very gigantic. The little blades on it were a couple feet long.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. You think of what could be...
Well, did you live on a... farm that had a
wind
charger system, 12-volt system. Well, wind chargers are still in business.
Turned on a little light, though.
I was going to say, describe your lifestyle.
But you're also talking about a very, very small generator, and it seems to me that the potential is there.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Now, how do you store it?
Storing it inside of a higher store.
Well, in case of the ocean currents, this wouldn't be as bad a problem, would it?